The early morning sun rose above the flat blue horizon like a fiery jewel, as if it had been disgorged from the depths of the Yangtze. The open river at dawn was beautiful, with the reflected sunrise shimmering on the surface. Kane, Brigid, Grant, and Lakesh gathered on the aft deck, using a bale of cargo as a makeshift table and a collection of small barrels and kegs as chairs. The Cerberus warriors had slept in hammocks in the crew's quarters and been awakened at dawn by the smell of hot food. Breakfast was a mixture of white rice mixed with bits of fish, slices of orange, and a thick gravy. The four of them brought plates up to the deck and tried to eat with chopsticks. Unsurprisingly, only Lakesh and Brigid showed any facility with the wooden utensils. After dropping more food on their laps and the deck than in their mouths, Grant and Kane ended up scooping it out of the plates with their fingers. They glared at Brigid and Lakesh in the process, silently daring them to criticize.
Has anyone seen Erica this morning?
The great lady has yet to emerge from her boudoir. She's probably waiting for someone to draw her a milk bath.
Lakesh frowned at him in disapproval.
I don't think you understand the extent of physical and emotional trauma inflicted upon her. She's wounded in both body and spirit.
You have some inside knowledge about that?
One doesn't need any to realize Erica requires our understanding and time to heal. I doubt we'll see her for hours, if at all.
As if on cue, Erica Van Sloan made her entrance topside. They were all surprised into momentary speechlessness by her appearance. Instead of the disheveled and pain-racked creature they had seen the night before, Erica was stunning in a red silk blouse embroidered with heavy golden thread depicting coiling dragon forms. The high collar did not detract from the long, slender column of her throat. Her black hair was smooth and sleekly brushed, framing the calm, sculptured beauty of her face. If not for the scratch marring the alabaster perfection of her cheek and the black patch covering her right eye, none of them would have guessed she had incurred so much as a stubbed toe the day before. A square of white gauze was barely visible at the edges of the patch. Only the dark fires glinting in her left eye denoted any emotion. Erica strode across the deck, taking long, measured strides. When she reached the makeshift table, she nodded regally.
Good morning, my friends. I trust you slept well.
Kane extended the middle finger of his right hand, to which a clump of stewed fish clung.
Care to join your friends at breakfast?
The captain informs me we'll reach our destination by late afternoon, so it's best we discuss how to proceed.
Just what destination is that?
A temple in the Wuxia Gorge region. But that's only where we will disembark. The next leg of our journey is overland.
Do tell.
Grant pushed a keg toward her with a foot.
Take a pew and start talking.
Annoyance at the big man's casual tone flashed in Erica's eye.
Do you have the ring on you, Mohandas?
Lakesh produced it from a pocket of his field jacket, holding it out to her on the palm of his hand for inspection. She reached for it, but he closed his fingers around it.
I'll keep hold of the only ring Wei Qiang doesn't yet have in his possession, if you don't mind.
Her shoulders stiffened at his tone, edged as it was with recrimination.
It's my property.
The hell it is. God knows who it originally belonged to, but nothing in that pyramid is yours. You didn't even inherit it.
More than likely, Wang Ti was the original owner. And if Wei Qiang is really the Yellow Emperor, he's only reclaiming what is rightfully his.
Perhaps so. But I don't think he can activate the Kai Bu Zhu with only 8 of them.
Activate? So you think the Armor of Immortality, if it really exists, is some sort of machine?
Of a sort. A machine of the Anunnaki, I'm betting. It's either a version of or the template for various magic cauldrons that figure in ancient legends.
What are you talking about?
The Cauldron of Dagda provided food for everyone, and the Cauldron of Bran the Blessed conferred rebirth. In Greek mythology, the priestess Medea restored people to youth in a magic cauldron.
In the case of the Cauldron of Bran, it could only restore the dead to life as long as the 9 rings of eternal return were worn upon the fingers.
Are we going to look for a cauldron or a suit of armor?
Both, maybe.
Erica nodded, her manner becoming a bit less formal.
During my time in the pyramid, I tried to catalog all the relics and artifacts stored in the vault, indexing them in the correct cultural and chronological order. It wasn't easy, because so much of it was derived from Anunnaki and Danann technology. Imagine trying to put together a huge jigsaw puzzle with all the pieces manufactured in different epochs, different lands and different societies, and none of them having more than the most general idea of the final picture.
The confusion was probably engendered deliberately, you know. That way, mere humans couldn't put the artifacts to use for their own purposes or benefit.
Probably. But all of us here know that the Anunnaki selected certain humans, certain genotypes and extended family groups for eugenics experiments. Over many generations, over a period of centuries, they sampled, reordered, and realigned their DNA in tiny details. They isolated particularly desirable genes and spliced them with others. They pre-selected the makeup of the entire genetic blueprint. The individuals subjected to this process passed on this set of precisely planned characteristics.
And those individuals became the first God Kings, the Anunnaki intermediaries. So you postulate that Wong Ti was one of those?
Yes. One of the first in this part of the world. I think Enlil took a special interest in him.
Why do you think that?
First-hand experience, Grant. Only Sam knew the nature of all the artifacts within the vault of the pyramid. And since Sam was Enlil...
And Enlil was Chang'an, the Yellow Emperor's guardian dragon.
Exactly. I'm positive Enlil is responsible for sending Wei Qiang to oust me from the pyramid, using the rings and the promise of restored youth as an inducement.
She cut her eyes sideways over to Lakesh.
And some of us know how powerful an inducement that can be.
And you expect us to believe that Enlil all of a sudden decided to evict you and he raised an army for Wei Qiang so he could do it?
Why not?
If Enlil is behind this, he depended on the Millennial Consortium to do all the hard stuff. The fact that the soldiers are armed with Kalikos proves that much.
Lakesh tugged at his nose contemplatively.
Assuming that's the case, why is he using Wei Qiang for this? Why not do it himself?
Kane and Grant exchanged glances, then looked expectantly over at Bridget.
That's a good question, Baptiste. What do you think?
I think, and I'm only speculating, that Enlil wants control of China again, but he's too overextended to embark on a war of conquest with his own forces. Who knows? He may not want the other members of the Supreme Council to know what he's doing. Therefore, he's using Wei Qiang to do the conquering for him, like he did in the old days. But the Millennial Consortium is supplying the army. Enlil is manipulating them both.
Oh, goddamn arrogant snake faces. They're sneakier now than when they were barons.
No one disagreed. For the past 3+ years, Lakesh, Kane, Bridget, and the movement had struggled to dismantle the machine of baronial tyranny in America. Then, a little over a year before, the entire dynamic of the struggle against the Nine Barons changed. The Cerberus warriors learned that the fragile hybrid barons, despite being close to a century old, were only in a larval or chrysalis stage of their development. Overnight, they changed. When that happened, the war against the baronies themselves ended, but a new one, far greater in scope, began. The baronies had not fallen in the conventional sense through attrition, war, or coups d'etat. The barons had simply walked away from their vills, their territories, and their subjects. When they evolved into their true forms, incarnations of the ancient Anunnaki overlords, their avaricious scope expanded to encompass the entire world and every thinking creature on it. Of course, the overlords were engaged in reclaiming their ancient ancestral kingdoms in Mesopotamia. They had yet to cast their covetous gaze back to the North American continent, but it was only a matter of time. Before that occurred, Cerberus was determined to build some sort of unified resistance against them, but the undertaking proved far more difficult and frustrating than even the cynical Kane or the impatient Grant had imagined.
Let me get this straight. Enlil wants to take possession of China again, but he wants Wei Qiang to be his puppet on the throne?
Apparently, that was the same deal he cut with Wong Ti and all of his other alter egos down through the centuries. At some point, he and Wong Ti must have had a falling out. At the very least, he no longer had access to the Nine Rings of Eternal Return and the Armor of Immortality, and so he began to age. Apparently very slowly, but he did grow older.
Which strongly suggests that periodic treatments are required to maintain a relative level of youth and vitality. Apparently, when both the armor and the rings work together, it makes the human organism immune to disease or breakdown of the cellular structure.
Kane tried to comprehend all the implications.
Are you saying Huang Ti can never die?
Oh, he could have his throat slit or be clubbed to death in his bed. That may be the source of the tales of Shi Wangdi's paranoia about assassination. But if he didn't suffer any accidents and chance worked in his favor, he could conceivably live for what seems like forever.
Why didn't Wang Ti retrieve the rings and armor before now?
Erica shrugged, then winced, gingerly massaging her injured shoulder.
He may not have known where the rings were, or, if he did, how to retrieve them. And of course, the armor is useless without the rings.
With only one of them, the armor is useless to us, too.
The corner of Bridget's mouth lifted in a smile.
Even with all 9 rings in our possession, the armor won't do us any good either. I'm certain it's programmed to interface only with Wang Ti's genetic structure.
Grant's brows drew down, turning his face into a ferocious mask.
Then why the hell are we on the opposite side of the world trying to lay claim to the damn thing?
So we won't have to contend with an immortal plenipotentiary of Enlil. Besides, the less Anunnaki technology floating around free, the better it is for us, for humanity.
Bridget's eyes suddenly acquired a hard emerald sheen as if a notion had just occurred to her.
Better for you personally, too.
What do you mean?
Bridget gestured to Erica and to Lakesh.
You two are probably the most brilliant human scientific brains currently alive. Erica is an expert on nanotechnology, and you know more about quantum physics, both theoretical and practical, than anyone in the last 200 years.
So?
They think they can reprogram the rings and the armor to work on them.
Kane glared first at Erica, then at Lakesh, barely able to restrain himself from grabbing the man by the throat. All the pent-up anger, the old resentments he still harbored toward Lakesh and the man's conspiratorial tactics came fountaining up within him. Shortly after his resurrection from stasis, Lakesh had rifled genetic records to find the qualifications he deemed the most desirable to breed into potential warriors in his cause. Kane's family line possessed those qualities: high intelligence, superior adaptive traits, and a resistance to disease. Kane wasn't a superhuman, but he was a superior one, one of the top candidates of the Purity Control Program. A few years before, Lakesh had arranged for Bethlehem Rauch to be brought into the redoubt to mate with Kane, to ensure that his superior abilities were passed on to offspring. From a clinical point of view, Lakesh's plan to turn Cerberus from a sanctuary into a colony made sense. To ensure that Kane's superior qualities were passed on, mating him with a woman who met the standards of purity control was the most logical course of action. Without access to the ectogenesis techniques of fetal development outside the womb, the conventional means of procreation was the only option. And that meant sex and passion and ultimately the fury of a woman scorned. Kane had refused to cooperate for a variety of reasons, primarily because he felt the plan was a continuation of sinister elements that had brought about the nuke cost and the tyranny of the Vils.
Is that true? You two are in cahoots to make yourselves immortal?
Don't be an ass, Kane. And that goes for all of you. Erica and I are not in cahoots, but by working together, it is possible we can change the system around so it will work on everyone.
When were you going to tell us this was the plan?
It's not a plan, Baptiste. Mahandas and I have not discussed it, but both of us had the same goal in mind. Who wouldn't?
That's a damn good question. Because the answer would include the entire Supreme Council, not just Enlil. And it's still only supposition that he has a claw in this particular pie, if at all.
I agree. It seems more like a consortium operation to me.
I don't know anything about this millennial consortium of yours, but I know how Enlil's mind works. Deception and diversion.
Yeah, you ought to know all about that. He tricked you into thinking you were his mom.
You're on my turf now, Grant, so watch your mouth.
Quiet. I hear something.
Like what?
Kane didn't answer at first, tilting his head back to scan the blue, cloud-flecked sky.
I've heard it before. We all have.
Bridget turned her head this way and that, like a foxhound.
Right.
They stood up, shielding their eyes with their hands as they looked from east to west, north to south. A couple of crewmen stared at them in puzzlement. With a sudden shimmering, a section of the eastern sky rippled like water sluicing over a pane of dusty glass and revealing an image behind it. A glinting silver orb appeared 100 yards away, a featureless disk of molten silver 20 feet in diameter. Perfectly centered on the disk's underside bulged a half-dome like the boss of a shield.
Shit. They had their LOC working. They could have been following us since the second we arrived at Shan.
He referred to the skyship's low observability camouflage screen. Microcomputers within the smart metal hulls sensed the color and shade of the background and exactly mirrored the image, rendering them invisible. The disk shot forward on a direct course with the junk, skimming over the river surface like a discus tossed by an athlete. The water parted before it in a wide V, a foaming rooster tail following in its wake. When the disk was less than half a second away from colliding with the junk broadside, it executed a vertical L maneuver and shot straight up, missing the tall mainmast by a matter of inches, not feet. The downdraft hit, and the ship rocked violently, the rigging swaying, the sails belling out. The silver disk ship swooped upward, then curved in a parabolic course to the south. In between one heartbeat and another, it vanished from sight.
Friend Grant, I believe you were mentioning something about Enlil's involvement being only supposition.
Grant refused to be baited.
If that was really Enlil in the ship, why didn't he just scuttle us?
The reason is obvious. Isn't it, Mohandas?
Lakesh nodded and turned, holding up the Hydra's ring between thumb and forefinger.
We still have one ring. Enlil can't take the chance of losing it at the bottom of the Yangtze.
The heavy sail had been rigged to keep the junk heading into the wind, but still she drifted toward the mouth of the gorge. The vessel creaked and the taut sailcloth boomed, intercut with the humming vibration of rigging as strong gusts sang through it.
Traveling the Wushak Gorge is as difficult as climbing up to the sky. That's what Li Bai said, anyhow.
Who's that?
Kane lowered the binoculars and cleaned the lenses of water droplets.
Li Bai was a poet of the Tang Dynasty. He was known for his lamentations.
Yeah, well, so are you.
He returned his attention to the castellated cliffs looming at least 1,000 feet above on both sides of the Yangtze. Through his binoculars, he studied the high ramparts, then swept the lenses over the river as it flowed between the walls of the gorge, waves crashing and breaking on the bare stone, foaming spray flying in all directions. Small inlets and estuaries drawing away from the main waterway split the rock formations. On the narrow shoals at the foot of the cliffs lay the remains of wrecked boats, heaps of splintered timbers and flapping, ragged sails.
Damned rough water ahead.
He tugged up the collar of his mag coat.
How do you propose we get through it?
Very carefully.
For the past few hours, the river had gradually narrowed to the point where both banks were visible, as well as a number of channels running around muddy islands, little more than dark fingers of rock thrusting up from the surface. They passed fishing villages, collections of small huts propped up on stilts, and they saw more boat traffic. The junk stayed with the main channel, keeping as far away as possible from the other craft, and none of them paid the bigger boat much attention. The four outlanders remained standing in the bow. In the distance, beyond the sheer cliffs rising from the water, they saw a long line of ridges and peaks still capped in snow, shouldering up from the hazy horizon. The junk eased past an upthrust of black rock that jutted 15 feet above the surface of the river. One side of it was quarried smooth, and several ideograms were chiseled deep into it.
If I'm reading it correctly, the inscription says, Wuxia's peaks rise higher and higher.
Is that a warning or just a fairly obvious observation?
Bridget pointed to the inscriptions.
The character Wu refers to a shaman. This gorge was named after an imperial physician called Wu Xian, who lived during the time of Yu the Great. According to fable, the goddess Yao Ji and her 11 sisters quelled some unruly river dragons and then turned themselves into mountains, thoughtfully positioned to help guide ships downriver.
I think we'll need all the help we can get.
In the pilot house, Sun Fan worked the wheel as the ship was caught by a current that swept it toward a cleft between the cliffs. Carried by the current, racing more swiftly than the river itself, the junk picked up speed. The dark walls seemed to plunge toward them. Studying the precipices towering high above, Kane glimpsed four oblong shapes dangling over a stone crag on the right by thick hawsers.
Those look like coffins up there.
They are. It was a burial custom of the Ba people, dating back over 2,000 years.
What kind of custom is that?
No one is sure. However, the Ba people, who were dwarves, had reputations for perverse behavior, such as protesting against heaven for their small statures. One such protest, for example, took the form of wearing too many clothes in summer and too few in winter.
Yeah, that would get heaven's sympathy, all right.
In ancient Chinese lore, they were reputed to be gatekeepers at the pillars of heaven, since they refused to enter themselves.
What does that mean?
I don't know.
The Yangtze rose and fell under the boat as Sun Fan steered it closer to the gorge mouth. The gap widened and became a gushing channel swirling around broken rocks, spray rising like smoke. The junk quivered, then sprang like a wild animal into the heart of the churning, turbulent strait. Mist and spray swirled past the prow. The river beyond the bow disappeared in a cloud of vapor as it flowed into a stretch of whitewater rapids. Lochish, Grant, Bridget, and Kane backed away, taking up positions amidships, clutching at the crisscross of rigging. Although he didn't say so, Kane was envious of Erica riding out the last leg of the voyage in her stateroom below. Bridget stared straight ahead, her long lava-hued hair streaming straight out behind her in the gusts. The boat plunged into the strait between the slick walls of the narrow gorge. It pitched and jumped as it shot forward. Sun Fan took his vessel through, sliding with inches to spare past half-submerged boulders and jagged fingers of stone. The concourse cut through gigantic tumbles of granite and basalt, huge boulders that had fallen from the cliffs over the centuries. Suddenly, the junk lurched violently. Everywhere, sailors went staggering and stumbling. The boat still had momentum enough to drag free of whatever had snagged the hull. They heard Sun Fan swearing viciously in Mandarin as he fought the wheel. The strait widened and the boat plunged between the cleft walls and into less agitated but still violent water. The white swells threatened to pile the vessel up on the shoals, but the foaming river calmed as the junk moved away from the throat of the strait. Exultancy swept the deck, and the men shouted in joyful triumph when they realized they had emerged intact. Although relieved, Kane didn't feel like cheering. His sixth sense of danger deepened as he stood up and took stock of their surroundings. A light mist hung over the river, and the surface glistened with an oily sheen, which only added to the hallucinatory quality of the scene spread out before and above the bow of the boat. Everyone stood up and stared.
This has got to be the place.
The sight was not only strange, it was scarcely believable. On the right-hand face of the gorge, a group of small pavilions with brilliantly colored roofs clung to the slopes, sprouting like tenacious wildflowers. The structures carried their gazes upward from the upturned eaves to a gray crag, upon which was perched a building out of an oriental fantasy, like a page ripped from a storybook and somehow given immense dimension and breadth. The huge pagoda dominated the stone bastions, the cloud-obscured afternoon sunlight winking from the gold-leaf spire rising from a roof gleaming with glazed tiles of green, blue, and purple. A wide, horned gate with a huge bronze disc suspended from the crossbar led to a shadowy portico. Golden dragons and foo dogs snarled down from the angles of the great gate. Constructed of arches and angles, the temple looked ancient. Overlaid by a thick coating of blood-red lacquer, the support columns crawled with leering demons and slithering dragons. The temple looked beautiful, but there was something unnatural, even menacing about it. Erica came up from behind the Cerberus Quartet.
Yes, it's definitely the place.
Lakesh glanced over his shoulder at her, noting she was armed and dressed for the weather, wearing a black hooded cloak. Her one visible eye was fixed intently upon the pagoda.
You've yet to explain sufficiently what kind of place it is. Surely not the mausoleum itself.
No, more like the visitor's center or information booth to a cemetery. We should find the keys to the mausoleum there.
Both Grant and Kane turned, staring at her in disbelief.
The keys? You mean anybody at any time could just stroll up there, grab a key, and unlock the damn door to the crypt?
No, I don't mean that at all.
Sun Fan ordered the sail unfurled, and when a breeze filled it, he steered the junk toward a stone jetty extending from the base of the gorge wall. Several quays and docks were built around a spit of rock that jutted into the Yangtze. A wide stairway stretched steeply up from the landing, the steps chiseled out of the rock. Turning the wheel, Sun Fan held the junk's stern straight for the jetty. He ran alongside it, so close that the hull scraped the pilings. As the boat bobbed in the shallows, two of the crew leaped down to the pier and secured it to a cleat with a hawser, snugging the craft fast and tight. A gangplank was put in place, and the outlanders disembarked, carrying all of their gear. Lakesh had the interphaser securely strapped over a shoulder.
We will remain here for the night and wait for you until noon tomorrow. If you don't come back...
A wise decision, Captain. If we don't return by then, most likely we never will. I am grateful to you for your service, Captain.
Sun Fan ducked his head reverentially.
It has been my honor, Tui Tui John.
He formally shook hands with the others, then he walked back up the gangplank to the junk. Without hesitation, the quintet began trudging up the damp steps. Erica took the lead, moving calmly between the crags of upright stone that had been carved by the elements into bizarre shapes.
"You need to brief us about what we'll find at the top, Dragon Mama."
She glanced down at him over his shoulder, pushing the hood back on her cape and shaking her hair free. Tiny beads of moisture glittered on it, as if diamonds dusted her black tresses. Her face was austere, but made sinister by the black eye patch.
"All I know are the legends."
"That's usually what we operate by anyway. I know a little about this region. It was central to the saga of the Three Kingdoms, which was a period between the disintegration of the Han Dynasty and the subsequent reunification of China under the Qin Dynasty. During that time, there arose three kingdoms and three sovereigns who vied to unify and control the nation."
"Yes. The kingdoms were the Wei, based in northern China, the Shu, based in western Sichuan, and the Wu, based south of the lower Yangtze. Allegedly, the temple was built on the site of the final battle to determine the fate of the three kingdoms."
The quintet steadily scaled the time-pitted risers, picking their way carefully. In some places, the steps were slippery and cracked. Erica's upward gait was a smooth, gliding motion, her legs invisible under the cloak. As she walked, she spoke, sounding not the least bit winded.
"The battle was very fierce. The Feng Shen text contains an account that all sides wielded weapons that were obviously not native to China 5,000 years ago. So-called wind wheels launched hosts of silver dragons. Mirrors on tripods radiated deadly heat, globes of fire and lightning darts. Immortals riding on flying dragons joined in the slaughter. At the end of the battle, 700,000 soldiers died. Corpses were piled as high as mountains. Two of the sovereigns were dead. The third was appointed ruler of all China."
"Let me guess. Shi Huangdi, who was really Huang Ti, and who now travels under the name of Hui Qiang."
"Who can say? The war between immortals and men ravaging ancient China may be only a fantasy, but the time frame for all of this to take place corresponds with the rise of the God King system in Sumeria. Of course, it was after that period the Chinese made the dragon a symbol of their civilization, believing that the celestial dragon was the father of the first dynasty of divine emperors."
Erica paused on a wide step, allowing the others to move up beside her and catch their breath. They were more than halfway to the summit.
"The three sovereigns and all of their descendants are reputed to be buried here in a network of tombs. But if they were ever found, no official report was released, much like the secrecy surrounding the Xian Pyramid."
"Are you claiming we'll find a necropolis up above? A Chinese version of the Egyptian Valley of Kings?"
"I'm not sure what we'll find. But ancient lore claims that only those with the bloodline of the first dynasty, the three sovereigns, can use the keys to enter the mausoleums. Almost all of the ancient birth and burial records were destroyed by Shi Huangdi. But one thing all Chinese believe is that there was an age of legendary immortals who accomplished fantastic things with the help of celestial beings."
2,000 or more years before the birth of Christ, Chinese scholars reported sightings of Sui Jing, luminous globes that monitored the activities of the emperors.
Grant looked up, eyeing the sky apprehensively. The sky was overcast, covered by leaden clouds. He glanced behind him, looking at the countryside cut through by the Yangtze, the details lost in the blowing rain, and to the west and south, where the looming mountains bulked dark and grim. The Wuxia Gorge itself was like a giant water-filled crack through the world. A movement at the mouth of the strait caught his eye, and he squinted at the distant shape of what appeared to be a wide, flat fan boat, but he couldn't discern any details.
"If Enlil is behind all of this, why couldn't he have already picked up Wei Qiang, Musgrave, a squad of soldiers, and flown them right to the temple? And they've been waiting to spring an ambush on us since yesterday."
"You don't understand Enlil at all."
"And you do?"
"When he was in the guise of Sam, we shared a dream of a new Earth. You couldn't comprehend it."
"I think we could. He called it the Great Plan. His objective was to control all of humanity by turning everyone into extensions of himself. We put a stop to it."
"Yeah. It was one of the high points of my life, if you must know.
You sure of that?
Kane nodded, moving around her and continuing the climb.
More than anything.
Erica and Bridget walked side by side.
Why are you so certain that Enlil won't jump us and just take the ring?
Because Enlil is testing Wei Qiang to determine if he is worthy of again serving as his viceroy.
Supposition. You still love him.
If I do, it's not a love you could possibly understand.
I wouldn't want to. My sleep is disturbed enough already without new disgusting thoughts floating around in my head.
You bitch!
Ah!
Bridget staggered and caught herself, just as Erica, her violet eye blazing, wound up to strike her again, cloak swirling about her. Bridget shunted Erica's blow aside and pounded a left hook into her midriff. The black-haired woman jackknifed at the waist and fell away toward the jetty 200 feet below. Erica's cloak saved her. Bridget snatched its wide hem, and for a heart-stopping instant, she held the tall woman suspended over the abyss, the toes of her boots barely making contact with the crumbling edge of a riser. For a long moment, as she held Erica over the brink, she stared into her wide eye. There was no fear, and the woman uttered no outcry. Bridget couldn't even guess at the nature of the wild thoughts possessing her. Then she pulled Erica in, yanking her upward. Erica fell against her, then flung herself swiftly away and flattened against the rock wall, arms wide against the granite. Erica's face was chalk white.
Why didn't you let me fall?
Don't believe for a second that I didn't think about it.
I apologize for slapping you.
Erica massaged her stomach and grimaced.
As you should.
Bridget rubbed the side of her face.
Hey, you two. You expect us to carry or what?
Bridget glanced up to see an irritated Kane a score of yards above them. Neither he, Lakesh, nor Grant had witnessed the scene between her and Erica.
We're taking a little breather. Go on up without us.
That's not going to happen. You've got the food.
Erica and Bridget both shook their heads and resumed the climb. The stairway led into a short tunnel under a retaining wall. They made their way up the steep slant, boots slipping on the wet stones. The stairs climbed through the passage and onto a rock-strewed plateau. The path widened into a miniature walled plaza, a flagstone path winding among the colorful pavilions. The quintet followed the path toward the pagoda, moving in single file. There was the smell of wet vegetation in the air and the faintest whiff of wood smoke. The pavilions, arched bridges, and red gates were like half-remembered dreams of imperial China, from a time of armored warriors, feudal castles, lords, and ladies of the courts.
Chinese temple courtyards were built with traditional concepts of the five elements that were believed to constitute the universe and the eight diagrams of divination in mind. The underlying concepts of yin and yang, harmony and balance, and the feng shui principles of geomancy dominate all architectural activity. Hence the preference for concentric or symmetrical construction.
Yeah, I remember you talking about that geomancy stuff from the Cambodian op. I thought I'd forgotten most of it.
You'd be surprised at the volume of information the mind can retain, friend Grant.
Not really.
The arched entranceway did not have doors, so they strode in. The interior of the pagoda was cool, cavernously hollow and dim. The diluted late-afternoon sunlight slanted in from high openings, but did not illuminate much beyond where the shafts fell. Moving quietly, the quintet walked through a huge audience hall with ancient frescoes on the walls, mosaic tiles on the floor, and massive serpentine columns supporting the ceiling. Dead leaves were piled in corners like the nests of wild animals. Here and there, the walls showed blackened soot streaks from cooking fires. Two huge pillars stretched up to the ceiling. Gilded and jeweled carvings of ferocious horn-headed demons guarded both of them. Ragged banners emblazoned with intricate calligraphy hung from the high crossbar, their colors faded. Between the columns, a broken prayer wheel lay amid a smashed row of stone tiger dogs and a tipped-over statue of Buddha. To reach the opposite doorway, they had to pass between the pillars and wend their way through the wreckage. Erica tilted her head up, gazing at the banners.
The pillars of heaven?
I don't think anybody has been here in a while. It almost looks like the place has been deliberately defiled.
Who would do that? Perhaps someone who is protesting heaven.
Then, six dark figures lunged at them through the gloom. Kane and Grant sprang back and flexed their wrists. Their attackers were very short, scarcely more than 4 feet tall, squat and bow-legged, with sallow yellow skin and slitted eyes in their ugly, pushed-in bulldog faces. Matted, coarse black hair was knotted at the backs of their heads. They wore only red-dyed leather loincloths, and bizarre tattoos writhed over their ropey limbs and torsos. Although small in stature, their arms rippled with knotted sinew and muscled tissue. The dwarves attacked, armed only with slender rods of ebony or some smooth black wood about 2 feet long, knobbed at both ends. The round balls gleamed with jade inlays.
The Ba has to be.
Anybody speak their language?
The dwarves formed a circle around them. The quintet moved back to back, all of them drawing their weapons.
I don't think there is a Ba language. Perhaps a local or tribal dialect, but they haven't spoken yet.
Neither Kane nor Grant wanted to shoot the stunted people, since they and their friends were the trespassers. The two men had killed enough indigenous peoples in their years as magistrates and preferred now to find alternatives to violence if possible. However, it didn't appear as if the dwarves intended to give them another option. One of them charged forward, black rod held out before him like a spear. A 240-grain round caught the Ba in the chest and sent him reeling away to thud against one of the columns and slide down to the littered floor, leaving a smear of scarlet on the wood in his wake. Then the dwarves were on them like rabid wolves. They were exceptionally swift, agile, and adept in the use of the rods. One laid a knob along Kane's wrist with a flickering stroke like that of a striking serpent. The black ball seemed only to graze his sleeve, but the shock of the blow numbed his arm from wrist to shoulder. He couldn't depress the trigger stun of his sin eater.
Watch it! Those things are like shock sticks!
Another rod struck Bridget's forearm at the clump of ganglia on the inside of her elbow, and her TP-9 fell spinning from her suddenly useless fingers. Still, she was far from helpless. She kicked a dwarf in the groin, and as he reflexively bent to clutch at his crotch, she brought a knee up into his throat. He went down. Grant's shot caught one of the stunted creatures in the right knee. The dwarf dropped to the floor, clutching at his maimed leg. If he didn't die from blood loss or shock, Grant felt certain he would be crippled. As he bent to snatch up Bridget's auto pistol, an ebony knob slammed against his temple with agonizing force, sending crimson flares of pain lancing through his skull and down into his neck. He was only dimly aware of falling, fighting to stay conscious. A rod struck the barrel of Lakesh's Colt, and a numbing shock was transmitted through the steel into his hand, streaking up his arm to the shoulder socket. The pistol dropped from his nerveless fingers.
Those aren't just pieces of wood!
No, they're the keys to the mausoleum!
Scalding agony lanced through Kane's left leg from the back of his knee to his thigh. The muscles felt like they were seizing, the veins injected with molten lead. His leg buckled and he went down, barely able to catch himself on his left hand, his paralyzed right arm hanging at his side like a slab of frozen beef. Erika's toy-like Makarov discharged, and two of the half-naked little men flailed backward. A black baton clattered to the tiles and rolled across the floor. Bridget stretched out an arm to grab it, but she caught a blur of movement from behind her. She twisted aside, taking the impact of a knob on her right hip. Pain shivered through her, but if the rod had struck squarely where it had been aimed, the impact could have cracked her spine. Still, she reeled clumsily, overwhelmed by the sudden stunning pain. She stumbled against Erika, who caught her and kept her from falling, but she was also prevented from shooting again. Lakesh snatched the length of wood up, briefly examined it, and swung it at a dwarf who had crept too close, smacking the hinge of his jaw with a knobbed tip. Although the blow landed solidly, Lakesh was surprised at the force with which the little man's head was jerked around. The whole lower portion of his face skewed sidewise, the point of his chin skidding around and taking a position beneath his right earlobe. His teeth spewed out of his mouth like a handful of corn mixed with a torrent of blood. Life went out of his eyes with the suddenness of a candle flame being extinguished.
The thing transmits some sort of electromagnetic jolt on contact. Repeated hits are probably fatal.
You think?
Grant shambled erect, kneading the side of his head. Reaching down, he secured a grip on the collar of Kane's coat and hauled him upright. More of the dwarves loped out of the murk, but they were armed with makeshift knives and clubs rather than the black batons. Kane clumsily drew his combat knife with his left hand, and Bridget fumbled with her copperhead, holding it with one hand. The dwarves made a sudden concerted rush, trying to bowl them over through numbers and momentum. Within seconds, four little gnarled corpses lay on the floor, crimsoning the tiles. The surviving dwarves drew back, black eyes glinting with malignant fires. They shuffled in a circle around the foreign interlopers, poised for another charge.
I'm going to try something.
I wish you would.
Then fucking do it fast.
Sensation was returning slowly to his arm and leg, but both limbs felt distant, as if they were separated by miles from the rest of his body. Reaching into the pocket of his field jacket, Lakesh extended his left hand, fist clenched tightly. The dwarves eyed it apprehensively, but did not retreat.
Junju!
The Ba people jumped at the words, eyes widening in surprise for a second, then slitting again in suspicion and smoldering hatred. Like a conjurer performing a trick, Lakesh opened his hand with a flourish. The dim light gleamed on the 9 hydra heads of the ring he held between thumb and forefinger.
Junju! Junju, you ugly little warts!
The dwarves froze in place, staring intently at the ring. Then they withdrew as silently as wraiths, leaving their dead and wounded behind. Kane squinted into the gloom after them.
Interesting. Junju were the words Wei Qiang soldiers were yelling.
Yes, it means true monarch. That, in conjunction with showing the Ba people the ring, made them think we are acting in the true monarch's interests.
Bridget eyed the rod in Lakesh's hand and glanced over at Erica.
Erica, you say those sticks are keys to the mausoleum?
Yes.
She picked up another baton that lay on the floor.
They look like the pictures I saw in the scrolls kept in the pyramid.
And since the Ba people are associated with the role of gatekeeper, the connection seems obvious now.
Can we get the hell out of here and talk more about it outside?
I think that's a very good idea. I suggest we do it on our way to the Tomb of the 3 Sovereigns.